Welcome to this episode of Revolution and Ideology. I am Nick.
I'm Jared.
And it has been a while. We are back. I don't even know how long it's been. A year, maybe? Has it been that long?
It's been too long. Definitely getting some comments and some emails and whatnot that it's been a minute. We've just been busy with other projects and other things going on. But we're here. We're here. So
today we are talking about Carl Mannheim. And specifically his book, Ideology and Utopia. I created a new course, I don't even know when, in the past 18 months or something, Introduction to Political Sociology. And one of the things we talk about there, we have a unit on ideology, and we talk about Carl Mannheim. We also talk about this in our humanities course, Ideology and Isms, though super briefly. I think it's like one slide on some lecture or something. So just a short bio on Mannheim real fast. If you know anything about us and how we talk, we don't do lengthy bios, but he lived 1893 to 1947. That time frame is important, just the sort of the lineage of his scholarship. Marx died, I think it was 1883. And so essentially in the sort of, you know, lineage of the theory of ideology, it's sort of like Marx, then Lukács, then immediately after that is Mannheim, in sort of the Marxist vein, though Mannheim's not really a Marxist, but we'll get to that in a second. So anyways, the time frame, that's why it's important. He started in Hungary. That's where he was born. He got his PhD from the University of Budapest, though he studied in Berlin and Paris as well. He was forced to leave Hungary and then taught in Germany, which is kind of ironic that he was exiled from Hungary and decided to land in Germany, which, as we know, didn't last very long. He left Germany in 1933 when he was ousted by the Nazi regime, and he settled in London for the rest of his life. There he taught at the London School of Economics and the University of London. Just an interesting trivia tidbit. I thought it was interesting that just before he died, he was invited to be the director of UNESCO, which I thought was interesting, but he was unable to accept the position because of his declining health, and he died shortly after. Most people, I would say, you know, we usually talk about, I think, probably pretty famous theorists and historian, like, you know, Foucault and Marx and et cetera. Mannheim may be one of the most obscure ones that we've talked about. If you're in sociology or philosophy or something, you've definitely heard of Mannheim, but outside of that, I don't know if you would have. He's incredibly famous in the field of sociology, which is why I'm talking about him, obviously. But
sometimes, like, thrown in those Frankfurt School, or ever is that a thing? Like, loosely, like, I get that he's not necessarily technically one, but does some
he get
thrown into that kind of mix from that era?
He's like Frankfurt School adjacent, is how I like to describe it. He's definitely not a Frankfurt School member, and he definitely butted heads with a lot of them, but. Yeah, he's in that milieu, definitely in Germany in the time, and then, you know, exiled like they all were, and et cetera. So, and a lot of their theories overlap. And, you know, a lot of his stuff, which you'll see as we start talking about it, is, I don't want to say connected as if it's the same, but like it's in the same space as like critical theory, et cetera. And a lot of people talk about, you know, the Marcuses and Adorno's and so forth sort of pick up the torch from Mannheim. Not that they did the same thing as him, but sort of evolved the way that we think about, you know, in critical theory and ideology and like so forth. So yeah, not a Frankfurt School member, but Frankfurt School adjacent. Like I said today, we're talking about his by far his most famous book, which is super commonly read in sociology, Ideology and Utopia, An Introduction to the Sociology of Knowledge. It was printed in Germany in 1929 and in English in 1936. I think Lukács, what is his book called? History and Class Consciousness or something like that. Something along those lines was like 1926 or 1923 or something. So just a few years before Mannheim's work. And we're not going to talk about how or anything, but they're related together a lot, sort of, like I said, in this lineage. Before we dive into Mannheim stuff, I'm just going to do a super short overview of Marx's concept of ideology, and I'm really just going to do a few bullet points. Though I will say, and I'm not committing to this by any stretch of the imagination because it might never happen, I really do want to do an episode on Marx's concept of ideology, but not just Marx himself. I want to do the whole like chain from Marx to Lenin to Lukács to Mannheim and on, and Althusser, and like, so we could really, I'm really interested in the topic of false class consciousness or false consciousness, because actually Mannheim, reading Mannheim is what sent me down the rabbit hole of false consciousness. And, you know, I've come to the realization that I think actually the way that we understand class consciousness, the way that we use it, false consciousness, I keep using those terms interchangeably, but you get the idea. I don't think it's actually in line with the original Marx and Engels way of thinking about false consciousness. Anyways, that's a diatribe. We'll come back to that.
But like my comment on that would be like, it's had to evolve, right? Like it's had to evolve
exactly.
From the 19th century to the 21st century. And I don't know that we need to be orthodox in our understanding. In other words, we don't need to
definitely
the way Marx did, because again, the world is not the one that he lived in. So I think that evolution is actually necessary. But anyway, all right, keep going. Yes, let's.
So in very simple terms, you know, Marx's largest contribution to the theories of ideology was the association of one's way of thinking to their economic class. And, you know, we totally take that for granted nowadays, like, but it's because of Marx that we do. I think that we really like sort of undersell how much of a seismic shift that really was, especially coming out of like traditional Hegelianism. You know, now we think like, well, yeah, of course, some wealthy person thinks that way because they're wealthy, right? But like that literally was not a thing before Marx and Engels like established that way of thinking. So that was Marx's big contribution. There's a really good paper by the name by Henry Drucker titled Marx's Concept of Ideology that was published in 1972 that sort of lays out, you know, Marx's way of thinking about ideology, which is really good. And that actually is one of the things that motivated me to want to go back and investigate that further too. But he says, you know, he suggests that there are two stages in Marx's thought about ideology and two sort of stages of ideology under the Marxist conception. He says, first, the theorists, meaning the ideologists of the dominant class, and if we're going to use Marxist term, right, these are the bourgeois ideologists, seek or create theories to justify their burgeoning position as the dominant class. And Drucker uses the example of Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, which was published in 1776, being adopted by the bourgeoisie as a scientific basis for their status. So essentially, as this, you know, as the social and economic material milieu is changing and this new dominant class is coming into being, the bourgeoisie during this time, they're kind of grasping at straws, looking for underlying theories that can justify their dominance. And so he says, you know, one of the examples was Wealth of Nations. And we all know, even to this day, this is like the Bible of the capitalists, right? And he says it was just coincidental that this work was published at this time that perfectly justified the dominance of the bourgeoisie. And so this is the first sort of stage of ideology, is the theorists are seeking something to justify their increasing dominance. Okay.
So like that's the material construct, right? That's how a lot of ideologies are created, is like material conditions already exist, and then something has to come out to rationalize, in this case, what we would probably both argue, this unethical class structure. And if you understand, right, as a human being, that what you're doing is probably unethical and you haven't really earned all of your wealth and so on and so forth, and this book comes out and you can cherry pick, because that's the key point. None of them read this thing in its entirety, but they can cherry pick little bits and pieces of what Smith was trying to say. That, of course, rationalizes what we would argue is probably their unethical feelings, their subconscious, their Jiminy Cricket, so to speak, saying, hey, maybe this isn't okay, but Adam Smith says X, Y, and Z. Again, when you read more of The Wealth of Nations, which I've become privy to over the last, I don't know, 6 months myself working on a different project, admittedly a little bit ignorant before that, there are parts in there that are intentionally now skipped over by capitalists that Smith was trying to advocate for regarding how this is going to operate, both materially and ideologically. So anyway, I'll let you keep going.
Well, and it's important that common...
I guess what I'm saying is the intentional misinterpretation of a grandiose text, which is not unique to The Wealth of Nations. We can look at religious texts or government texts. It happens all of the time. But The Wealth of Nations was a little bit more eye-opening when I went a little bit deeper into it a few months back. Maybe we do an episode on that later. But
and it's important to understand that, you know, the common misconception is that Adam Smith, quote unquote, invented capitalism by writing this book. But it's important to understand that he was just writing to describe what was already occurring, right? Yes. He didn't invent these theories. This was by 1776, most of the economic functions that are written about in The Wealth of Nations are already taking place, right? So Drucker's position and the Marxist position is that as the bourgeoisie were coming into dominance, they were just out there seeking, you know, things that would justify their position, and the Wealth of Nations fit that, you know, to a T, obviously. The next phase is the dominant class seeks ways of thinking that defend and further legitimize their position. So after they've achieved dominance, you know, they use these ways of thinking, et cetera, to sort of, quote unquote, prove that they should have this position. Now they have to make sure that they aren't unseated, essentially, right? So now they need ways of thinking and theories, et cetera, that justify their staying in their position and legitimize it. Drucker uses the term apologists here, and he uses the example of Thomas Malthus' stance on population and scarcity, which was published in 1798, which we're all probably familiar with, right? You know, this idea that there's just not enough to go around, right? And so as a result of scarce resources, you know, the elite would argue, well, why can't we all be elite, right? Why can't we have equality? Why can't everyone be the status that we have? Well, it's because, you know, Malthus's ideas fit to perfectly, quote unquote, scientifically, right, put these together. And this comes straight from Marx. Marx talks, writes extensively about Malthus. In fact, he argues that he just invented this, that there's nothing scientific about it, right? Which we don't even need to talk about. That's a whole other diatribe that I think is largely, I guess, I was going to say, everyone understands that it's been discredited at this point, but people still like to hang on to it because it is ideological. It serves an ideological function for them. But regardless, anyways, so first the theorists, the bourgeoisie ideologists, seek theories to justify the burgeoning class position of the bourgeoisie. Later, they seek theories that further legitimize and defend their position. Regardless, in the Marxist lexicon, the term ideology is always used pejoratively. So it's a charge against someone who is masking the true reality.
Yes.
Mannheim says, quote, the word ideology is used as a weapon by the proletariat against the dominant group, right? Now, what is reality if you're a Marxist, right? If an ideology is used to mask reality, well, what is reality? Well, for a Marxist, it's the economic material base of society, right? We talked about this extensively. It is the real world and the interaction of human beings with the natural environment and so forth to produce what they need to survive and so on.
Can we simplify that for people that might not have gone through all of Marx's ideology? So essentially what Mannheim is arguing at this point in time is that ideology is not necessarily reality. It is a manufactured rationale for the material conditions of the time, and it's manufactured by those in higher positions on the class structure to justify or rationalize their position, why there are haves and have-nots. So an easy
that's not your Mannheim, that's Marx. Like Marx straight says Marx. That. Yeah.
He's Marx. So an easy example of that would be something along the lines of like the bootstrap ideology or the rugged individualism, that if you have not achieved as much as you're supposed to achieve in, say, modern ultra-capitalist United States, it's because you haven't worked hard enough. And there's a whole ideology that's attached to it from the Protestant work ethic, of which we've done episodes on down the line, right, to Reaganomics and so on and so forth. Like starting, I don't know why I chose Reaganomics, but there's a pretty big gap between the original Protestant work ethic and Reaganomics. But the idea is there, right? There's an evolution. I skipped over a whole bunch of steps along the way, but that's part of that evolution, right? And that is that justification for that stratification, again, for lack of a better term.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about Mannheim's main differences, sort of where he departs from the traditional Marxist concept of ideology. He first acknowledges Marx's valuable contribution. He says, quote, it was Marx's theory which first gave due emphasis to the role of class position and class interest in thought. And like I said, we take that for granted today, but that definitely was a seismic shift in the way that we thought about, you know, why people think things. And in Ideology and Utopia, interestingly, Mannheim does have a section where he kind of traces the history of this concept of ideology, which we've done before for class, like talking about, you know, France and Destrossi and the way that Napoleon uses it and so forth. And he even goes into some stuff that I had never even like really thought about that was really interesting. We're not going to do that here, but he traces the sort of history of this concept up to Marx. However, Mannheim, and this is his big departure, he argues that things have evolved beyond the basic Marxist conception of ideology. He says, quote, in the course of more recent intellectual and social development, i.e. Marx's writing, However, this stage has already been passed. It is no longer the exclusive privilege of the socialist thinkers to trace bourgeois thought to ideological foundations and thereby to discredit it. Nowadays, groups of every standpoint use this weapon against all the rest. As a result, we are entering upon a new epoch in social and intellectual development. So he's saying Marx's concept of ideology no longer applies because nowadays everyone can charge everyone else with being an ideologist. For example, the opponents of Marxism can and do to this day say that Marxism itself is just an ideology.
Right.
So, you know, he's saying when Marx was thinking about the concept of ideology, perhaps it was valid. But now things have evolved to such an extent that now that Marx has popularized this concept of ideology, that this knowledge of ideology has, you know, diffused its way into common knowledge. And so now everyone can charge everyone with being an ideologist. So it's no longer just tied to class where proletariat can charge the bourgeoisie with being ideologists and using ideology as a weapon to, you know, subdue them, etc. That now everyone is aware of this concept, and so now everyone can just charge everyone else with being an ideologist. And this is really Mannheim's main jumping off point, at least for our purposes here, is this. You know, it's that if every way of thinking, every viewpoint is ideological, then how do we judge a way of thinking as being true or false? What is reality and what ways of thinking function to distort or conceal reality? This is referred to in the scholarship as Mannheim's paradox. So Mannheim's paradox is, if everything is ideological, then what is reality? How do we know what's real? And how do we know what is ideological? What is distorting, you know, reality and what isn't? So clearly this is a problem. So we're going to walk through, you know, how he seeks to escape from this position in his book, Ideology and Utopia. But I'm going to give you a spoiler alert. He doesn't. He tries to. And in my opinion, and most other critics of this work, he's not very successful. And the further we go, the muddier things become. So it's a fun journey. But if you're in this for like some kind of resolution at the end, you're going to be sorely disappointed. But it's interesting to think about, you know, his philosophies and how things change as a result. And it's no surprise that this work garners, I mean, we're talking about the 1930s in Germany. So you can think of, if you know anything about philosophy, this is like a hotbed of, you know, philosophical thought. It gets critiques from hundreds and hundreds of like prominent philosophers, this work. So incredibly popular, prominent, and criticized as a result of the things that he says. So, okay, how do we get out of Mannheim's paradox? First, he says we must adopt a non-evaluative stance. So obviously, like I said, the Marxist use of ideology is that it is a pejorative, right? We're judging other people by saying that they are ideological, or when Marx talks about bourgeois ideology, right, and its functions. Mannheim says, first, we have to step back and realize that if everything's an ideology, we can't judge something as ideological because our thinking itself is also ideological. So everything is an ideology. So from what position are we judging something as an ideology if our position itself is ideological? He says we can't judge, that we can only seek to understand. So if we want to understand, we must approach it not from a position of judging and critiquing, but of understanding. And he calls this position relationism. He says we must begin by gaining an understanding of the relationships between all different ways of thinking. Now, if you're watching this on YouTube, you're looking at a diagram here. Jared and I are looking at this picture. This isn't Mannheim's. This is just a diagram I got off the internet because it illustrates this well. It's just a node and edge diagram with nodes connected so you can visualize their relationships, right? So according to Mannheim, you know, each of the nodes here would be different ways of thinking, different ideologies, and all the edges, the lines that connect them are the relationships between each of them. So he's saying we first have to take this non-evaluative position and we have to understand the relations between all different ways of thinking. So we have to get this total picture of all the sphere of thought, essentially, first. That's sort of the first step.
Well, and their relationships with each other and how they affect each other, right? Some are antithetical, some are reflective, right? That would be, so if we use modern ideologies, when I'm looking at this image right here, I don't know if it's on the screen for everybody. Well, I guess you said it is on for YouTube, but not maybe on the pod. But regardless, let's say number four in a modern sense is nationalism, and number seven is capitalism, and number 10 is positivism. And like in some ways, they might have things where they don't agree, but those are like filtered and reflective and bouncing off each other and all kind of help manufacture each other, even if they're like antithetical. So again, an easy example would be socialism and capitalism, in theory antithetical, but not really. They're still, the understanding of the ideology is related to the understanding of the other ideology. And that's what makes both ideological, which of course is an irony when we're talking about it through the Marxist filter we just got done talking about.
And like this picture doesn't have arrows, but the idea is that it goes both ways, right? It's these things have a reflexive relationship with one another. So exactly what you said.
Yeah.
So it's a continuous process also, which is important. Like this is a static picture clearly, but this interaction is going on continuously, right? Throughout space and time. So it's, obviously it's complicated. Go ahead. You had something else?
And that's why someone might hold the view that somehow, I don't know, like free market economics and protecting those are tied to American exceptionalism, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Technically, the nationalism part and the economic part, the capitalism part, are two different ideologies, but that's a way in which there is that reflexive relationship, if that makes sense.
No, 100%. That's a great example of how there's one node that is connected to two other nodes, and then they have this complex relationship, right? For sure. And obviously here we're thinking about, I don't know how many are in this diagram, 10 right nodes, right? But in the real world, it's probably infinite, right? So, you know, one of the most common critiques of ideology nowadays, now that these theories have evolved, you know, is if ideology is all encompassing, how can we possibly critique and judge ideology? You know, if we are inside ideology, how can we judge ideology if our thoughts are also ideological? This approach sort of, and I have sort literally in italics in my notes, sort of addresses this. We are still able to understand the relationships between ideologies, even though we are inside sort of all of these things, right? So I can be, you know, I guess I wouldn't be a node in this diagram, but like we exist within this social milieu that it consists of all these nodes and edges. But since we're not trying to judge, we can understand, right? I know that it's not super convincing, but that's sort of the approach here, that if we take off, we eliminate the goal of trying to judge and critique, and we only go forward with the goal of understanding, then we can do that from the inside. We cannot critique from the inside, which is how Mannheim lands at this first step, right? We have to completely remove the goal of critiquing and only adopt the goal of understanding. And that is possible from the inside. Do you have any thoughts on this?
I mean, as of right this second, while you continue to teach me this, but before we get further, I would argue that's very difficult to do.
I'm not saying it's possible, right? Like, so, yeah.
It relates back to like when you're talking about inside and outside, I mean, Plato's cave, we've already talked about it numerous times in past episodes, right? Like, can you truly like critique from inside the cave when you don't understand reality and all of the possibilities that are outside, right? Can you actually do that? Because everything you know is filtered in this case by the puppeteers. And yes, maybe academics like ourselves and the ones that are exponentially smarter than us have more puppeteers available to them, or they've researched more puppeteers, quote unquote, so they might know a little bit more than the average person, but they're still puppeteers. That's, I guess, the point I'm making. So there's still an ideological filter on those glasses that we are viewing the world through.
Although you just made the common error, right? You started your whole paragraph with how can we possibly critique from the inside. That's Mannheim's whole goal, right? We're not trying to critique, we're just seeking to understand. Allegory of Plato's cave, right? Pretend that we're not seeking to escape, we're just seeking to understand the dynamics of what's going on in the cave, right? That's the first step. We'll get to the next step, which is
merely changing that word though from critique to understand. Could those prisoners understand from within the cave? That's what obviously he's going to try and tackle, and let's go forward and see if he does, which you said
the key here though is the relationships, right? Yeah. So it's the edges in the graph, if you're looking at the graph or if you've ever seen a node and edge graph. It's important to note that this is not relativism. And Mannheim painstakingly tries to point this out, right? He doesn't want to be defined as a relativist, you know, and if relativism, if you don't know, it claims that there's no absolute truth and that morality, ethics, and so on can only be judged relative to a given framework of assessment. So cultural norms, individual standards, religious rules, etc. Yeah, exactly. So this isn't relativism, right? We're not judging things based on some other framework. We're only seeking to understand the relationships between these different ways of thinking. So Mannheim's initial position, relationism simply gives the highest importance to the relationships between ways of thinking with each other and with the material world. Now, this position for Mannheim was supposed to be the task of the sociology of knowledge, which is how we get the subtitle in the book. You know, it's Ideology and Utopia, an Introduction to the Sociology of Knowledge. He's not the first person that coined this term. There was one before him, but he by far is viewed as sort of the quote unquote father of the sociology of knowledge. And this book is like the key text in that field of thought. And so for Mannheim, the sociology of knowledge was supposed to be this objective position one could adopt to seek to understand the, I guess I shouldn't even have said objective position. There's no position that is objective. Even Mannheim admits that. But this position that could sort of stand back, be non-evaluative, and seek to understand the relationships between all the different ways of thinking. Now, this then begs the question, even if we could obtain a perfect knowledge of all of the ways in which different ways of thinking relate to one another and to the material world, how do we evaluate what is true, what is right, what is wrong? Because isn't that the entire point of ideology, right? So even if we've done this first step, and let's say we succeeded, which Jared pointed out is probably impossible, and I absolutely, obviously would agree, like not possible for any one human being to fully understand the ways in which every single ideology relates to one another, especially, like I said, it's this sort of like four-dimensional process that's going on through space and time, this reflexive relationship between all of them, right? So if you're looking at the static diagram, not only is it changing all the time, it's also floating through time and space, right? So it's like, how could any one human being fully understand that? Well, the answer is they can't. But that's a whole other like critique of this. You know, maybe someday AI can understand it, and that's the point when we're all in trouble. But just kidding. So how do we go from that position? Let's say that we did. How do we go from that position to being evaluative? And remember that I said the further we go, sort of the muddier it gets, and kind of the less, you know, believable in my opinion it is. He says, then from that position of the perfect non-evaluative understanding, we can then go into more of an evaluative and critical position. So the next step for Mannheim is a sort of return to the evaluative position, now armed with our knowledge of how all of the ways of thinking relate to one another and to the material world. And he says, we can judge the validity of a way of thinking by how consistent it is with the real world and what its function is. The real world for Mannheim is real life behavior, how people actually behave and function and interact. And the real world for Marxists is the base, right? If we think of base versus superstructure, where the base is the material world, it's the mode of production, right? And the superstructure is the ideal world, it's, you know, religion, et cetera. It's all the things that we think of. For Mannheim, it's actually a combination of the two. And this is where he definitely, you know, takes a detour from traditional Marxism, where he says reality is actually a combination of the material world and the superstructure. And we also, he points out, can't ignore the way that they relate to one another, sort of the reciprocal and reflexive relationship that the base and superstructure have. So that's reality for Mannheim. If you're watching this on YouTube, you're looking at a diagram right now that I've made just to try to help visualize sort of where we're going. So this is where we run into Mannheim's terms, ideology and utopia, which is clearly the title of the book. So he says we can view different ways of thinking based on how consistent they are with reality. And he says there are two different sort of categories, ideology and utopia. Both of them are not congruent with reality. So both of them are different than the way that people actually interact and behave and the material world and think, et cetera. So that's one of the only one that they have in common. So let's talk about ideology first, and then we'll talk about utopia. So ideology is not congruent with reality. It lags behind current reality. It functions, I'm going to go through these and then we'll talk about them individually. It functions to defend and legitimize the status quo, and it is conservative in nature. So Mannheim is saying that, you know, the social milieu is constantly evolving and progressing, and that ideology lags behind the current social status, the current social milieu, and it functions to defend the current status quo and legitimize stratification, etc. In that sense, it is conservative, right? Conservative seeks to prevent change and to make sure that things do not change. Now, if you remember back to Marx, this is, well, Drucker talking about Marx and his theory of ideology. This is sort of the, what did we call it? The apologists, right? The apologetic position. This is kind of the second phase in the Marxist conception of ideology, when the theorists are, the ideologists are seeking theories to legitimize their position. That kind of, no, I haven't seen a scholar that makes this connection, but I think it kind of helps to think about those two things being the same here, where, you know, Marx's second phase of ideology is kind of the same as Mannheim's ideology, at least the way that they defend and legitimize the status quo. So that's ideology. Do you have anything to discuss on that before we go to utopia and then talk about the differences between the two?
Sure. I mean, there's obviously exemplification, like ideology being conservative, it lags behind current reality, it is manufactured. There's some easy examples, right? Think about how the alpha male patriarchy is becoming popular again. That's not current reality. Life is not like that anymore. We're not living in the 50s, the 40s, or 30s here in the Western world anymore. And yet, like, the rise of that ethos, that ideology, that belief system is like that's ideological. They're grasping at something that no longer exists, and they're very like kind of like pushing it. Another easy example, white nationalism would be part of ideology. Anything that is really trying, under the auspices, I hate this cliche at this point, it's 4, 5, 6 years old, of trying to get back to something, making something great again, etc. Like, those are ideological beliefs, right? It legitimizes a status quo that may or may not even really exist anymore, but it's seeking to legitimize it, and it is conservative by nature. So those
would be... Well, and I'll stop and just interject that it doesn't exist anymore, period, right? In order for, according to Mannheim's definition, in order for something to be an ideology, it is by definition professing a reality that does not exist, right? Maybe it probably never existed, right? I mean, it didn't fully ever.
No, it's a romantic, right? In case of, yeah, like that, it's a romanticized past that didn't exist. We'll pick on the 1930s Germans that come along and actually kind of like move Mannheim and the Frankfurt School on.
Right.
They were trying to get back to something that never existed. That First and Second Reich, those were manufactured narratives and stories about a past that was never real for the German people. And of course, that idea of a Third Reich was them kind of appealing to the masses ideologically to change what the current reality looked like for Germany. And yes, while it did lead to a world war, the end result kind of shows that that reality was no longer sustainable, because even the past was not, it didn't exist either. So,
Okay, on to utopia. Utopia, like we said, is also non-congruent with reality, but it is ahead of reality. It is anticipating the next epoch. So while ideology lags behind, utopia is ahead, if that makes sense.
Sure.
While ideology seeks to defend the status quo, utopia seeks to shatter the current status quo. And where ideology is conservative, utopia is progressive. So Mannheim writes how utopia, it points out all of the things that could be, right? So all of the things that we could have in the future if it weren't for, you know, X, Y, and Z, or perhaps ideology, right? If we could eliminate ideology, we could achieve all of these great things and so forth. The utopians? What's the word?
Utopians.
Utopians.
Better. That sounds better.
Yeah. The utopians are seeking to achieve something, quote unquote, better, right, in the future. So that's the difference between ideology and utopia. It's important to understand that neither of them are in line with reality, according to Mannheim. but the way that they function is completely different. Does that make sense?
In a way, I'll wait to add more until I guess you teach me a little bit more about utopia, because in my mind, it is like revolutionary and seeking a paradigm shift. However, not without its own, and I don't know that I want to use this word because it's going to be misapplied now, but not without its own like ideological incongruencies. So like that's kind of the point.
Statement is perfect. We just have to can't use the term ideology, right? Which is weird. And that's where Mannheim gets confusing. But you're absolutely correct. And that's
this would be like if we critique, I don't know, something that we're fans of, if any of our listeners or watchers are used to our channel, right? Anarchy, for example, and anarchism, right? Very utopian. And but here's one of the common critiques that sometimes we both have a difficult time combating. Like it is utopian, right? Like it is not the reality, and the path to get there is going to run into a whole host of material and ideological circumstances that is going to make some sort of great anarcho-syndicalist society very difficult. In that way, I would argue that if we are defending it, we would both be acting somewhat ideologically or utopian. That would be my argument. But again, I'm trying so hard not to use that word ideology because he's applied it differently. But let's move forward.
I think that it's what you're saying is perfect, right? It's that then that's the point, is that the utopian position is also not realistic. It also doesn't accurately reflect reality. It serves similar functions, right? It's just a different position, right?
There's different
instead
goals,
of being behind, it's ahead. Instead of defending the status quo, it seeks to shatter it. And instead of being conservative, it's progressive, right?
Yeah.
But that doesn't, there's nothing about it. I mean, I guess something about it, but it's not wholly in line with reality. That's the whole point. Neither of them are, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So there's different goals and neither are aligned with reality. So back to something I had thought of as you were introducing the concept earlier, is there a way to understand ideology while within ideology? And I'm using the word understand now, even though there will be kind of like judgment later, right? The evaluative approach. Is there a way to do that? How can we view, I mean, here's the thing, not even necessarily viewing society, but viewing anything, can anything be absorbed by an individual without it being ideological? So what other ways do we gather information? If ideology has been socialized, and that I think Mannheim, Marx, and us would all agree, like it is manufactured in some way, shape, or form in societies, obviously most often from the top down, which is what they both are arguing. But is there a way to understand things? How did humans understand simple concepts before ideology? And we've talked about this before, observation, trial and error, testing, etc. Is that ideological as well? So like, I don't know, a child, more of a blank slate than some sort of like 50, 60 year old person who's been like, again, fully socialized in a whole bunch of ideologies by those nodes. When that person, that child learns something for the first time, is that not ideological? Let's say they see a grasshopper and they want to touch the grasshopper and they understand the notion of the grasshopper. There's nothing ideological about that, right? I don't know. What do you think?
I mean,
that's what I was thinking about earlier.
Yeah, it's like if we go down that path, we get to like consciousness, right? Which actually Mannheim writes about, which is interesting. He actually says that, you know, one of the biggest evolutions in the history of the concept of ideology is this concept of human consciousness. But we're obviously not going to go down that path right now. But I guess to your example of like the little child and the grasshopper, is there ever a point in a human being's life where their perspective on the world isn't shaped by ideology? My answer is like, I don't know, are they 5 years old and seeing this grasshopper in the field? Well, then they're indoctrinated, right? I guess not fully, but they're somewhat indoctrinated.
Their notion of the grasshopper and even the word would probably be somewhat ideological when a parent shows up and says, hey, that's a grasshopper. But I don't even know if I want to go that far. Let's take a dark turn for just a second as an animal advocate myself. But let's pretend that child grabs the grasshopper and begins to pull a leg off. That to me is like ethically incorrect, but I'm viewing that very ideologically. For that child, is that child, could we argue that that child in this first exposure to a grasshopper is doing this because of some sort of socialized understanding that they are supposed to hate that grasshopper? Maybe it's a pest or vermin or whatever. Maybe they've learned that, but let's pretend they haven't. And they just, out of curiosity, because of observation and trial and error, they want to know what happens. Is that ideological? Is that act that I would consider, because of my ideology, unethical or immoral, evil, bad, whatever, is that for the child also those things? Well, no, I would argue if the child doesn't know any better, that child is performing that act of pulling the leg off outside of ideology. Would Mannheim agree?
I mean, this is the conversation between, like, you know, instinct and socialization, and the difference between like human beings as like primal animals and human beings as like conscious, you know, reflective entities. I don't know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I personally don't know the answer to that. I also don't fully know where Mannheim would stand on that either.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we're at the point of like, when does a human being become socialized, right? Well, most people nowadays would argue that it happens in the womb, right? That by the time we're out, it's not to say like you come out of the womb a capitalist or whatever, but by the time you've already been hearing things, right? Your environment is already impacting you. I guess that's where I want to go, right? The environment, the surrounding environment, even when you're in the womb, right? Most people agree now is already impacting the way that you're developing, right? So would we call that fully ideology? Like, that's probably a stretch, but, you know, there's some kind of influence there.
And then that leads me to the next question in this, like, kind of like step between ideology, reality, and utopia, whatever utopia looks like in the future, based on, again, somewhat of an ideological filter, which we've just discussed. We're doing things perhaps right this second in 2024 that would make us akin to probably a five-year-old when and if somebody in 3024 looks back on us. And would they be arguing that these choices were made because of ideology or because of actually the antithesis? If we're the five-year-old, is it, to be blunt, ignorance? And we're still learning through observation and trial and error.
Well, so let's talk about the critiques of this model first, because part of that will answer part of that question, I think. So there are two critiques which Mannheim mentions. It's not like these come after the fact. One of them is that the critique of ideology here can only come from the utopian position. I have utopian written right here. I don't know why I struggled with it so much before. The critique of ideology can only come from the utopian position. So only can the utopian charge someone with being an ideologist, right? Yeah. The ideologist can't charge anyone else with being an ideologist because they can only charge them with being utopian, right? If that makes sense, right? Clearly. So that's one of the critiques here. That leads us to the second one, which kind of gets to what the question you were saying about the person in year 3000 is, that it's only really possible to determine which positions are ideological and which positions are utopian post hoc, meaning after a new epoch has come into being. So we can only look back through history and say, oh, well, clearly these people at the time were being ideological. They were conservative, et cetera, lagging behind the status quo and so forth. And this group of people or this way of thinking was really the utopians, Mannheim's version of utopians, right? Where they weren't fully in line with the reality at the time, but they had ideas that did actually come into being, and they definitely shattered the status quo and were progressive, right? Does that make sense?
Thomas Paine, the people in year 3000. Before it was a thing, would be like a historical example, right? Like,
yeah, and he would be considered utopian, like at the time, at least that particular position that he had, right?
The Washingtons and Jeffersons for being, whatever, morally problematic for slavery. So he's ahead of his time before it was like a larger movement, if that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, and I mean, we could apply this model to like every revolution throughout history, right? Which we could do easily, but I think it's pretty simple probably, right?
Okay.
It's easy to go back in time and do it. It's much more challenging, if not impossible, to do it in real time, right? Like right now. So right now, who are the utopians and who are the ideologists, right? Well, it depends on that position, depends on your ideology. right? Clearly.
And it also depends on what you might consider progressive, right? Some might argue, no,
exactly.
Like, I don't know, electric vehicles, as we've discussed in the past, is like progressive. In the future, that's all that there is. But that path was set now. And I would argue that the path that that is on is also ideological. So that utopia would not be my utopia, but that in and of itself is ideological on my part. This is kind of like, there's no answer.
No, there is no answer. And that's kind of the point, right? Is that even though Mannheim lays out this, you know, utopia, ideology, reality, the question still remains is, well, okay, what is reality? What are we judging it against, right? Well, we can only do that in retrospect, essentially, is one of the critiques of Mannheim's real theory. And like I said, we were never going to end this episode with some kind of resolution.
No.
It just gets muddier. And we're just in this like circular logic. Right.
But I guess the one thing I would say is those people considering these things in retrospect are also in their own current like ideological situation themselves. So that it even their interpretation of the past, whether it was ideological or utopic, is filtered through a socialized understanding of how these things, how there is this interplay between the ideal and material world.
Yeah, we've talked about this extensively in the channel, right? Like history itself is ideological.
Yeah.
Right. There are facts that almost everyone agrees on, and then there are like truths that are modified depending on ideology, right? For sure, 100%. This is like a random, I guess, reference, but I've always enjoyed, one of my favorite directors is Werner Herzog. Do you know who that is?
I am aware of the name, but I don't care enough to know all the directors of my favorite films. I'm not,
He often gets critique because he manufactures a lot of things in his documentary films. And his response, which I thought was great, I can't remember where he made it, but it was in an interview that I watched of him, is like, there's always two truths, right? Like, if you want to make a documentary about the people in New York City, the truth is the phone book, right? That's the truth. Those are the people in New York City. But I'm not, as a documentary filmmaker, I don't want, he calls it the accountant's truth. I don't want the accountant's truth. That's not what I'm doing. I am telling a story as a filmmaker, and that by necessity requires the manufacturing of truths, right? I have to create this story. No story exists in real life. But if you want the truth, you read the phone book. If you want to be entertained, you watch a film. And that's what my job is, which I've always thought was an interesting position to have, right?
Yeah.
I don't even know how we got on that tangent, what we were even talking about. But anyways, okay, so that's Mannheim and sort of Mannheim's paradox and how he attempts to get out of it. And I mean, no one reads Mannheim and is like, oh, wow, I get it. He fully escapes the paradox, right? Even he himself never admitted that. And he struggled with this, right? This was a position that he backed himself into that no one has gotten out of to this day, right? So I guess we can thank Mannheim for presenting the paradox, but we don't get to thank him or anyone after him for helping us escape the paradox. I do want to mention, though, when you read Mannheim and the scholarship on Mannheim, I cannot help but just to be slapped in the face with how similar this is to Foucault and a lot of the things that Foucault talks about with, you know, the fact that there is no objective truth and like so forth. And even within the sociology of knowledge, really the lineage goes from Mannheim to Foucault, sociology of, you know, how knowledge is constructed and so forth. And, you know, we've talked about that actually extensively on this channel too. And, you know, all that kind of stuff, the archaeology of knowledge and so forth. So there's a lot. I tried to look if there's actually proof that like how Mannheim influenced Foucault, if Foucault even read Mannheim, et cetera. And I couldn't actually dig a lot, find anything, but I assume that he had to have at least be aware just based on, you know, what he was doing with his life and how prominent Mannheim was and like so forth. So that's just an interesting connection there. Anything else?
That's it. No problem solved.
No problem solved. Problems created, no problem solved. But that's pretty much what we do here, I think. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed that, please subscribe. The podcast can be subscribed to wherever you listen to your podcasts. And we also have a YouTube channel if you're not watching this on YouTube, where we post all of our episodes as well at Revolution and Ideology. I am Nick.
I'm Jared.
Later.